more well-rounded and well-balanced life, capable of releasing intuitive faculties and becoming more or less integrated as a conscious being. Now, what would you suggest? How would we go around to help this person to do this? Well, the first thing we've got to find out, of course, is why he comes. And the reason he's there, usually, is because he's not satisfied with what he is or what he is doing. If he was successful in every sense of the word, he wouldn't be asking help from anybody. He has come because perhaps one of a half a dozen situations has set in. He's lost a loved one. Therefore, he looks forward to loneliness and wants to do something about that. He is nearing retirement age. He has made no preparation for this. Therefore, this particular problem confronts him. He can't, after all, cut the lawn every day. He has to have some other activity besides weeding the garden, presuming he has a garden. Also, perhaps his doctor told him that he's got to ease up, that he's too strenuous, that he's worrying too much, that he's getting an ulcer. He's got to learn to relax. Well, it's awfully hard to learn to relax when you can't think of anything that's interesting. Some other situation may arise. At almost anything. But the person is here seeking help simply because he suddenly recognizes a need or a defect in himself. So you can say to this person, perhaps to start off with, when you were young and growing up and starting out in life, what was your dream? Did you really dream that you were going to be in coats and suits? Did you dream that you were going to be an agent for the gadgets from some large transistor house? Was this what you started out that you wanted to be? And the man may stop for a moment and say, well, because after all, the thing I wanted to be at that time was pretty stupid. No, I'm not doing what I wanted to do then, but how can I? I wanted to be an opera tenor. And I never even had the voice. Well, you can start with that. That's something. Or this individual who can say, well, all my life I've been in an office, but what I wanted to do really was to go to sea on a ship and travel all over the world. And a housewife who has had quite an experience and is now a grandmother says, well, if you must know, I wanted to be a toe dancer. These are the problems that you get when you go back to try to find out what people wanted to be. Yet from these things that they wanted to be, you can often find a secret and locked situation. And if we could have found that out earlier, in many cases, there would be fewer people in our mental institutions. Because while in some cases they were able to carry this conflict rather well, in other cases they never could. And this thing they always wanted to be and never could be absolutely ruined their psychological integration and they never recovered it. But we have all these people now, and we have to find out where we can start with these people. It's obvious that they can't take up a new career as they would have at 20. Life circumstances no longer permit this. But there is somewhere lurking in this problem some way of centering them again on the one thing that every human being must ultimately come back to, and that is the release of his own consciousness through creativity. This has to come. If it doesn't come, he's lost. The person who always wanted to be a musician may not be a great musician and may never be able to. But they can still do something because here their whole instinct is located. And even at 80 or 85, they can start. They can express themselves in some way. They can take hold of a value which they need. And they can decide how much they're willing to sacrifice to take hold of that value. It may be that for a person in advanced years to buy an elaborate or expensive musical instrument is a real hardship. But if that music has waited for 50 years to come out, it must come out for that person's good. And that is not an expenditure, it is an investment. Because they must learn creativity. Now other people can develop the same lessons in a simpler way. Some individuals have, great many persons in our way of life, have had a frustrated desire to be artistic. Artistry meant something to them. As children, they had a little skill in drawing, but they never had a chance to do much with it. Along came life and set in with its problems. This artistry perhaps never got any further than maybe helping their children to draw a few pictures in their childhood. But this actually remains. Here is a potential area of creativity that the person brought with him into life. Something must be done to make sure that he takes that creativity out of this life further advanced than when he came in. His success in life will not be measured in his practical, methodical procedures, but in the degree to which he has released his own creative bent, whatever it may be, his own creative instinct. Persons who can no longer create in that sense of the word can discriminate. They can discover, they can experience value. And for many, many persons, art becomes a way out. One of the reasons is that art is in almost complete defiance of our common, ordinary way of doing things. Art is almost an auto-corrective for the kind of life we now live, which is far from artistic, and which almost completely loses sight of artistry. Most persons do have an instinctive desire for fitness, for the rightness of values. They want to look well. They want to have nice things. They want to set themselves in a framework of things that are interesting. And this brings another curious situation to mind. I know that in a large store in New York where I used to visit, they got in some very fantastic Middle Eastern jewelry. It was amazing material, utterly dramatic. And they exhibited it, and a great many very stylish people came to look at it. And many of them admired it, and many of them said they had never seen anything in their lives as remarkable. But nobody bought it. Why? Because nobody dared to wear it. You take a person who had absolutely no personality and hang a thing like that on them, and the next time they met a friend, the friend would say, "How do you do? That's a fine piece of jewelry you have." You wouldn't see the person anymore at all. The person was too weak to carry it. An interesting adornment must be carried by a still more interesting person, or it eclipses the person. And the next thing you know, they get an invitation to send the pin and not come themselves. Nobody's interested in them, but everyone would like to see the pin. Anything that is remarkable, different, startling, dramatic, can only serve a person who is able to carry it. Otherwise, it destroys that personality. The individual develops an inferiority complex to what he's wearing. So in order to live in an interesting place, to surround ourselves with interesting things, we must be interesting. Otherwise, we rattle around in something we don't fit into. And someone says to another person after they leave, "That's a marvelous house. How in the world did that person ever get to move into it?" Wrong. We've lost leadership by being surrounded by interest and not having any interest in us. So this is one of the reasons why it is so important for the individual to always lead his interest. This is why in taking hold of value, it is not important merely to own something. That something must express value in us. We must always lead this value. We must always be in control of it. If this value is something that represents centuries of culture in its production, it should be worn or carried by a person who has matured even more centuries of consciousness within themselves. Otherwise, there's discord. There's a hopeless situation that nothing can be done about. But there's always this important problem of the person leading his own cultural environment. And he can do it, but he has to think about it. He can have the courage to do it if he will give himself the insight necessary to mature his own activity and interest. This is one of the reasons why everything having a story, everything must be done for a reason, and everything that we have must have meaning to us. We must understand it. We must know why it is good. We must be able to appreciate that value in our own consciousness. Then it belongs to us by a natural and wonderful power of possession. We possess what we need, what we must have. And in some wonderful way, these things do come. Things are forever hunting for people. It isn't true that people are always just looking for things. Things are out looking for the people who can use them. And something happens and they come together when consciousness is right. Well, that's another phase of our problem. But we start out with these people who are trying to find activities, trying to find interests. I know a great many rather serious people these days who are taking up various interesting subjects with the understanding that every new subject that we take up opens a door. Now, this door that is opened usually opens into the creativity of our collective race. The person who suddenly discovers the creativity of man collectively suddenly finds himself a member of a magnificently interesting creature, a society of beings that he thought was a very dull society. But because he's gotten under the surface now and begun to move with the creativity of these people, he discovers that he is living in a world of extraordinary values if he is able to appreciate them. He learns that the simplest thing done well is a magnificent thing. So he opens doors wherever he touches the creativity of life. A man, a woman who studies a language, not his own, opens a door. Opens a door into a world not just of somebody else's speech, but of the psychology of peoples. To know people's language is to have a tremendous bond of union. To know a language is to understand more and more the soul of a people. And a whole universe of values is simply opened by this circumstance alone. I know a man who, having suffered a leg injury by which he was not going to be able to continue to get around very much, went down and studied in our southwest with some of the Navajo Indian silversmiths and became quite adroit and expert in molding and mounting silver with turquoise and other stones. He wasn't an Indian, but he gained a tremendous admiration of the magnificent craft of these people. He found he'd gone down to take 3 months study with them so he could find a hobby. He spent several years with them and gradually learned to know that even behind casting a simple Indian buckle, there was a world of thought, a world of skill, a world of wise methods and ancient traditions and wonderful lore. And when he came back, and not being able to get around, he had his little table, he had his wheelchair, and he would sit in front of his table and work with these things. He not only finally made some magnificent things in the Indian techniques, but he suddenly discovered that all this technique, now he had mastered it, gave expression to himself. And he made some tremendously interesting and dramatic, original ornamentations and devices. He found a world of self-expression in this. He found that this fact, the fact that he could turn out a beautiful piece of molded silver into an exquisite design, gave him more satisfaction, more peace of soul than all his bank account could possibly bestow. And he had the sense of creativity, that God in him was moving. Because God is God, primarily because of the great creative power which lies at the root of life. And whatever has creativity moving into expression has God coming into manifestation through that creativity. So there are all kinds of things to do. nearly always our soul satisfaction does not lie in purely intellectual hobbies. Our soul satisfaction lies in bright, glittery, silvery things that bring peace and joy and sparkle with them. Therefore, we usually collect articles or items of some beauty or of meaning. Another individual decided that he was going to attempt to decode Egyptian hieroglyphs. But he wasn't particularly addicted to such literary pursuits. It was interesting. He had a lot of fun with it. He spent several years working until he was pretty good at reading these glyphs, and he found some very interesting inscriptions. But he gradually hopped past this into something else. The first thing you know, Egyptian religion, Egyptian philosophy, Egyptian mysticism came through and took over. But he found the knowledge of the language extremely valuable, and it enabled him to decode many documents not generally known and to correct misinterpretations bearing upon the religious beliefs of these people. So he started with one thing, but he went on to what was his real interest. But this person could not be bored. This person could not any longer drop back into the mediocrity of just living from day to day. Each day was an adventure. And this type of adventuring is a much richer life than can ever be gained in the levels of success as we know them. Because success still leaves us bored. It leaves us numbed as far as value is concerned. So another person, at a suggestion, took up working with children, particularly children who had minor physical defects. This person was very much interested in the problems of children, but not just merely association. They had a feeling that in some way these defective children could be given a consciousness in life which would enable them to go on and have great lives and not be caught in the negation of some defect. The fact that the child was club-footed should not actually ruin the life of that child. Something had to be done to make that child's life so important that this deformity was not significant any more than the fact that Steinmetz was a hunchback made very much important difference. He was still regarded as one of the great men of his time, and he certainly was not limited to any serious degree by his physical deformity. He simply had a life so rich that he could carry this deformity with graciousness and with wonderful insight. And this man believed the children could be worked with in this way. He started something, and he gradually proved that he was right. And he was able to make some very interesting contributions to improving young people. And knowing this very sensitive period, say the first 6 or 8 years of life, when these deformities become suddenly a separating factor between one child and another, he worked through that period. That was many years ago, and some of the children he worked with have now grown up, and they are all much the better for having known him. He made something interesting out of something. He found his artistry in this way. But everyone must have some creative self-expression. And when the opportunity for this comes, he must grasp that opportunity because it is the greatest value that can come into his life. And depending on the circumstances and backgrounds and interests, limitations, means, localities where we live, these values have to unfold a little differently for each person. But each individual must, in this lifetime, to fulfill the purpose of life, not only be a provident person, a sincere person, and an intelligent person, but a person with dynamic interest in value. If he can achieve this, he then has some very good karmic patterns working for him and helping him to go on into a fuller expression of his own life purpose. And this is one, of course, the lessons that we gain from the study of art, because life is the greatest of the arts. And all art is merely some way a study in life, study in the in the drama of the great spiritual emotional unfoldment of human consciousness. So in arts we have these little symbols that we can set up as symbols of things we are going to accomplish in our own natures. Now, I've had people come to me, for instance, also who wanted to collect art, who felt that art was going to be one way in which they were going to suddenly become a little more sensitive. They were tired of nagging their children. They were tired of having their children nag them. They were tired of sitting around waiting for their arteries to harden. They wanted to do something. And having some means and some intelligent understanding and grasp, they decided they were going to take up some form of the simple thing which we call collecting. Now, collecting is a kite with a very long tail. Because when you start collecting, you say, I'm going to get three of these and put them in a row. You get the three of them in the row and you say, they don't look right there. You've got to do something about it. And first thing you know, playing, well, shall we say, secretary to your own art, your own art begins to affect you. And you can't have great art without any artistry in yourself. It begins to scream and yell. You have to mature in order to live with it. You have to learn what to do with it. You have to learn to think about it. Or else, little by little, it becomes a tyrant over your affairs. So, starting out on some field of this nature, we say, what are the situations that affect people? The American people today are more art conscious, probably, than we will ever realize. The one art, however, which has gained almost complete general favor is music. Music has become, to the American people, a tremendously redeeming force at this time in our social life. Music is the one art which we are willing to accept because it gives a tremendous amount and to the average person does not demand a great deal. Music can be very demanding. Music can cause the listener to become a great musicologist in his own right, but he can also just be a good listener. And that is where it is most of the time with us. There is, however, one little ulterior fact in here which we mustn't overlook, that in our modern interest of music, there's a good deal of mechanics involved. The average person today has become so tremendously interested in high fidelity and stereophonic sound and so forth that he is gradually changing from a music lover into an electrical engineer. This is not quite the original intention. But I know people who can't tell you the name of a single composer, but they know every element of a 300 circuit that they have, with more little pins and little switches and tiny little fuses in it than you could ever count. They know every one of them by name, but they don't know a single piece they hear over it. So this can get out of control also. And there can be the man who victoriously announced that he finally had the most perfect set in the world because when he played a certain recording on it, he could hear Leopold Stokowski breathe. This this was the final proof that he had a great set of a great musical equipment. So this is a common occurrence, but art with us, other than music, has been terribly neglected. Some funny things have happened, too. Some of them rather interesting and others still a little pathetic. One of the most interesting, curious, and almost a little pathetic things has happened is that you can now take out pictures in color from the public library on your library card, keep them at home and live with them for 30 days, and then bring them back and get another one. Now this is, I would say, a streamlined way of introducing art to the American home. Incidentally, you should see the pictures you can get out. I've seen them. And in the spirit of the time, most of them are pretty bad. They're famous, but they're pretty bad. Other cases now, you can rent pictures by the month. Also, I think far more to the point, for a small additional fee, the gallery will send someone to decide what picture you should have. After all, there is this problem of the wallpaper and the drapes. You can't have a picture that screams against the upholstery. So an interior decorator will help you to choose a picture that is just what you have always wanted, whether you know it or not. So art has a hard time in our way of life. It's a stepchild. We have forgotten that art is not a luxury of the rich, but a necessity of all peoples. We have not learned to realize that art is civilization, whether it be music or painting or drama or literature or poetry. There's something very serious wrong with a culture in which no book of poems can sell over 500 copies, no matter who writes it. Of course, some of them aren't worth any more than that, but some are. But you cannot get any recognition for poetry. You can get very little recognition for good theater. You can get very little recognition for any of these dramatic arts. They must be very flamboyant, very literal, and very noisy today in order to get any attention at all. Not to say the least that they must also be quite vulgar to be really successful. This type of thing is bad. It shows not that we are simply lacking art culture, it shows that we are falling apart. It shows that our whole culture is weakening. And it also shows that there is going to be more crime, more misery, more psychological breakdowns, more juvenile delinquency, more dope addiction, more acute alcoholism, unless this situation is cured. Because this collapse of culture is the collapse of a people. And if it goes beyond a certain degree, the nation or the race involved will not survive. So it becomes rather important to take hold on some of these things. Not only because we need the individual experience, but because we need to set an example for a collective experience, which is more than due. We are far too mature as a people to be merely a mechanistic industrial civilization. So we do want to do something with this artistic instinct in ourselves, to find repose, to find peace, to find tranquility of spirit, and most of all, to experience some sense of being valuable as people. Not simply because we can support the government through taxes, but because we have a creativity in us that can support life, can support civilization, the future of a world. Also, that we can bring more creativity to the lives of children around us and those whose lives are directly influenced by our own attitudes towards living. So we can take up other fields also. Some people can take up writing. They can attempt creative writing. We can write anything we want to as long as we don't expect to get it published. But that isn't the point. Many of the greatest literary works in the world were not published at all during the lifetime of the author. They were hidden somewhere, and 500 years later someone found them and thought they were rather good. It isn't important. We do not write for publication. We write primarily for expression, for creativity. And gradually, if we learn so that we are writing not just from the fullness of our hearts, but also have a little training in writing, many people will produce better literature than they are buying. But they just don't know this. But you have to add to the desire the willingness to train for a year or two under proper guidance and know what good writing is. This may increase vocabulary. This may help us to release psychological pressure. The most successful book of every author is usually the psychological story of himself. But he's gotten it out. He's gotten release from pressures and tendencies that have held him in bondage perhaps for half a lifetime. Writing is very good. All these things are good because they make us express something. I think the Japanese idea of the 17-unit poem is a tremendously intriguing thing. And here is something that could be a very great creative expression for our people. The American people are divided largely between the two groups, those who say very little and those who say too much. And to get it down to a very nice, moderate situation is wonderful. It also gives us conciseness. Now, if you can do a complete poem in 17 syllables, not 17 words, 17 syllables, and this poem becomes a masterpiece, you have achieved a number of things. First, you achieve tremendous inventiveness. Secondly, you have learned not to insult the person who reads the poem by filling in all the details for him. You learn how to draw with a very broad stroke, and you can put together the elements of one simple idea. It must be completely simple. And in the simplicity of this idea, you tell a wonderful story. You make a little fragment of existence. You sum it up. You relate it to value in some way. Well, this little poem in its 17 syllables must tell a story as well as describe a circumstance. If you can do this, you have gained a new control of the dimension of language. It is something really tremendously interesting and extremely worth thinking about. You can spend a great deal of time trying to see how much you can project in the form of a conscious experience in 17 syllables. You may find in the end that a great deal has been accomplished. Well, many wonderful things have been said very quickly. Someone pointed out long ago that the largest statement in the world that we know today is a very simple statement. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. How are you going to add to that? For a magnificent statement of total spiritual value, there are tremendous things that can be captured out of life experience with utter simplicity. And this is the beginning of a great maturity of literature for a people, and has a tremendous appeal to the thoughtful person as a discipline upon his own faculties. Another, of course, Oriental contribution to this problem is flower arrangement, a very interesting and dramatic area for human activity. Here we have man placed in a curious relationship with nature. Here we have man attempting to eliminate man and perfect art by revealing nature. To the degree that a flower arrangement indicates human activity, it is a failure. To the degree that the individual is able to arrange these flowers, leaves, and stems so that they appear that this is the way God grew them and that no one has touched them, to the degree that that can be done with the strange but inevitable abandon of divine order, to that degree, you have a great flower arrangement. Great because man has inwardly sensed how nature would do this thing. This is a tremendous intuitive experience, a tremendous inspirational experience. Now, it's harder for us to take hold of some abstract Oriental art, such as, for instance, the tea ceremony. I know a great many people who have seen it. I know very few non-Orientals who have appreciated it. To most Western people, it is a long, drawn-out way of pouring a cup of tea. And actually, because of the fact that powdered green tea is used, and you drink the powdered tea, grains and all, it's not exactly regarded as a delicious experience, even in the drinking of the tea, which is of about the consistency of sour soup. Therefore, it is not a greatly appreciated art among other people. But what is the actual idea behind it? It is complete self-discipline. It is a magnificent ability to perform a series of actions with every effort made possible to transform bodily motion into perfect poetry. The tea master becomes a living poem. He reduces the composition of this poem to a series of simple motions that almost suggest the 17-syllable poem. Everything is reduced to its starkest beauty. There isn't a wasted motion. Everything is done according to a tradition of the complete harmonic beauty of motion. It has a strange static parallel with the dance. For the tea ceremony is a kind of dance in which there is practically no motion, very little. But every movement is backed by the fullest consciousness of the artist. He is doing everything as though he was painting a magnificent picture. And he is doing it to an audience that appreciates what he is doing, who recognizes that it has taken him a lifetime to learn to do this. And a group of critics who, if he is poor at it, will not hesitate ultimately to let him know. But if he is good at it, will respect him for all of his attainment and admire him in many other phases of his living. So this becomes a tremendous discipline of ordered self-control. The attempt to express creatively total beauty of motion without anything except a tea bowl and a little dipper and a feather and two or three things like that to make this action possible. So here is perfect creative motion. And only an individual who has a thoughtfulness in this area can possibly appreciate it. Or the artistry which so often associates this ceremony with ceremonial suicide. It is a very subtle thing, but it represents a strange development of consciousness within this individual himself. So the artistry can take almost any form that we want or are able to use. But whatever it is, we must reach for it and take hold upon it. We must do something. And I believe that most people's lives would be far less negative in the hurt way. Most people suffer much more than they need to. Most people are sad or angry far more often than the circumstances, even at the most exaggerated interpretation, really would justify. Because this quality of preoccupation in value has not come into their lives, has not given them this wonderful vision of what could be if they would only let it be. Meditational disciplines also can create great artistry. But meditation really arises out of art. Wherever in Asia especially, you'll find great artistry. You'll find your meditational life. The meditational life in the West is an escape, usually, from a negative situation. In the East, it is the projection of an already existing positive situation. Your Zen monk is a great painter. Your Shingon mystic is a great, we may say, a great musician. He plays superbly upon some instrument. His artistry is tied very closely to his religion. And religion itself implies the impulse to creative expression through art. Look at Western culture for a moment. In the last 500 years, what great religious art has Western man produced? The last great European artist, perhaps, of dynamic, of religious art in Europe may have been Albrecht Dürer. I'm not thinking now of the very gentle, mystical souls, but of the ones who had tremendous dynamic in spiritual art. The only great artist in spiritual art that England ever produced was William Blake. I can't think of a single name outstanding in American art as a great interpreter of man's sacred conviction. Religious art has simply disappeared. The only thing that we get is a little maudlin sentimentalism. We get no dynamic in art. We say that Protestantism, dividing ceremonialism from the common life of the Protestant Christian, actually damaged his art instincts, because there's been very little art in Protestant Christianity. It was avoided as part of the old background that must be forgotten. There's been very little great music. Certainly, there is a wonderful, kindly sentiment in the old hymn. But as music, it is not exactly outstanding. and we do not produce greatness. Our religious life does not express through creativity. We go and sit and listen and go home again. But it doesn't move out of our lives through great music, through great painting, through great creative artistry, great theater, great literature. The real things of life that are most important to us are not articulate in our arts. And when we finally put the statue out in front of the city hall, it's something we don't know what it is after it's there. It's some absolute atrocity. We don't know. So our religious instinct is not creating self-expression. Perhaps it's because the average person isn't trained in self-expression. The average person has never taken an art lesson in his life, but he's trying to be a religious person. He needs both. He needs to have the value of knowing what is great and gradually moving his own conviction into manifestation. After he has learned to know what is good in art, he may also be able suddenly to discover that he can create it. If he doesn't know what's good, he will not know what he is creating. But religion should lead to creativity. It should lead to a tremendous dynamic in art. And if a great artist in religion should come along, this artist, for the continuance of his own inspiration or the effect of his artistry upon civilization, must have those who believe in his art, who support his art, who purchase his art. Otherwise, he will starve to death and disappear again in the great silence of the unknown and unrewarded creators. He must have someone who appreciates, or he cannot produce. So all through this modern way of life, we feel this brittleness. We feel this sudden sensing that everyone would like to foreclose a mortgage on us. We have the sense that everywhere we go, someone's trying to exploit us. Yet we are not doing anything to create the warmth which prevents exploitation and makes persons have a sense of kindliness toward each other rather than a quick desire to exploit each other. Where there's great art, there would be more understanding between people, more understanding between families. So to reach out into this value sense, I know from working a long time with people that those who have found artistic outlets have suddenly become better people, happier people, wiser people. The religion has meant something to them that it never meant before. Because they have sensed that the reason why we seek inside ourselves for truth is in order that we can free truth, that it can come out. Actually, religion must come from within us into our lives, into our activity. Religion is something sacred. If it moves into our lives, it must move into a manifestation with the dignity and graciousness of a sacred thing. When we decide to, or when we are impelled to release religion into action, it should cause beautiful action. It should cause noble action. It should cause the kind of action which is recognized by other people as superior, as something that has its root in a divine principle rather than in the common principle of human competition. Yet if we have this creative instinct, if we have this infinite desire to release religion, and we have no talent, no ability, no instrument for implementing this instinct, then we are like the individual who always wanted to be a musician but never trained his hands. We have to train. We have to gain appreciation. We have to gain sense of value. So while we are releasing religion from the inside, we are releasing discrimination from the intellectual and emotional levels of our natures. So that someday, the fact that we have gradually learned to understand what is valuable, what is beautiful, what is true, will instinctively equip us to express our own life beautifully and release our own conviction in a manner that is truly worthy of us. For there is a sermon in a beautiful thing which we have created. We are creating solely, as the old Chinese poet said, we are creating solely because God is in us. And if we turn and produce something magnificent, God is the artist. But we have become the faithful apprentices of that artist. Now, God is art. God is the creative artist, creating all beauty and all good things in the world, can never be truly sensed or known unless we are also artists. When the time came in the alchemists of the Middle Ages to produce the mysterious transmutation of metals, they had a patron saint, a mysterious, unknown, elusive being who was called Elias Artista, Elias the artist. And those who transmuted in chemistry base metals into gold were referred to as artists. Therefore, alchemy was an art, and alchemy was the transmutation of all base things into beautiful things. The reformation of human society, the transmutation of the base metal of undeveloped character into the pure gold of illumination. And these things were accomplished because of the power and the secret wisdom that was communicated by Elias Artista, the master of the alchemical mysteries. Elias the artist. And all great transmutation and transformation of self is art. The art of making a magnificent likeness of God in the nature of man himself. The skill to sculptor our own character into the likeness of truth. These are all great arts. And great arts and little arts are brethren of different ages, but of the same family. So by gradually becoming maturely aware of beauty and of true value and of the finer things of life, we refine our own natures. And as a result of that, the divine principle moving through us manifests more purely its own magnificence. The person who has great music in his soul has already the power, in some mysterious way, to be closer to the music of the spheres, to be to the music of the infinite. The musician can discover God as music. The artist can discover God as great art. The poet finds deity as the great poet, whose very poems unfold in the heavens like a scroll. Everything is available to those who have discovered the sensitivity of great creative value. And I think each one of us should try to hold on to this value, which is the experience of the creativity of beauty. And we gain it little by little through simple means. But finally, as it matures within ourselves, we move from the mere appreciation of fine things to the embodiment of fineness, so that all good things move through us to their own fulfillment without being detoured by some blank area in our own appreciation. I think that this type of thing is of the greatest value. It is hard to talk about, but it is more conveniently experienced than described. And anyone who takes hold upon value anywhere and holds to it tightly and allows it to lead him will come in the end to this kind of mystical experience, which makes life a very much more rich and wonderful span of years, and makes every life, no matter how humble in its common circumstances, makes every life a great life, an important life, and a creative life. Well, I guess time is up, so we'll have to end this ramblings, and we'll ramble on again next week. Thank you very much.